This episode is brought to you by Bento Box, helping restaurants bring hospitality online. Learn more at getbento.com/opening soon. That's GETBENTO.com/opening soon.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to Opening Soon on Heritage Radio Network. We are your hosts. I'm Jenny Goodman.
And I'm Alex McCreary.
And if you're just tuning in to our first season, this is a podcast that will walk you through the steps of opening a restaurant, from finding business partners to real estate to sourcing, which we'll talk about today. And we'll be picking the brains of some of the world's greatest chefs, restaurateurs, and the vendors that help take their business from an idea to opening soon.
And if you've listened to one of our earlier episodes, then you'll probably have figured out that we're not very good at opening restaurants ourselves. But we're pretty good at making workwear with our company Till at NYC, which is how we've come to meet so many great restaurateurs and people starting their businesses, and kind of seeing how they've gone from just their idea to their opening soon. And thought that this show would be a great outlet for, you know, sort of transferring that knowledge onto anybody else that's thinking about opening a restaurant.
So we will be chatting today with Morgan Tucker of M. Tucker and Josh Morgan. There's two Morgans, but so don't get confused. The COO of Melt Shop and an operating partner in Orify Brands. But before we delve into our conversation on sourcing with them, we're going to wrap up some key takeaways from our show last week, which was with Aaron and Agatha of Ovenly, and we chatted real estate, and I think we could have talked to them for 7 hours
next season. A lot of good information. Number one was get a lawyer, and don't just get any lawyer. Make sure that you get a good one. You're going to be dealing with, you know, lots and lots of paperwork, and when it comes down to it, your lease on your place could make or break your business.
Yeah, lifetime of the business. Another thing they pointed out were some specifics within the lease that are good things to have, especially if you're in New York City. They said good guy clause, which is a key piece. And then also be careful of assignment clauses, making sure if you're bringing in investors or want to have the opportunity to sublet, that you have something in there that you say you have an assignment clause.
And number three is to request a white box. You know, the more work that you can get your landlord to do for you, the more cash you can save and reserve, and you can actually focus on the things that you're really good at, like cooking and, you know, building your brands.
Yeah, and they were said to be creative too, which I thought was interesting. Like, if the landlord's saying no, then like see if you can finance some of the work within the terms of your lease.
Right.
The other key takeaway was the lease analysis document. So making sure that you're looking to see the number of tables and the number of turns you're going to be able to do, that your rent is never more than 10% of what those estimated gross sales are going to be, so you can actually pay the bills, and making sure that you can actually make your money back within the term of your lease, whether it's a 5+5 or a 10+5.
Right. And the last one, number five, is embracing opportunity is not luck. And so this point was dropped by Aaron, and I think makes a lot of sense, you know, not just in real estate, but obviously your entire business, your entire life, you know, putting yourself in the position through education, through career, through connections, to really capitalize on an opportunity is, you know, there's a lot of work in there. Don't call it luck.
That's so true. We work hard to be, you know, opportunistic.
Our sixth takeaway,
yeah,
is that IKEA is not sustainable.
That's true. That's from Morgan, who will talk to us about plates and dishware that could be sustainable shortly. That is very true. It's not breaks and chips. I love it that you listened. Thank you.
Of course. And so, I'm rocking my Tillet jumpsuit today.
Yeah, Morgan is decked. She looks pretty good in her jumpsuit. So this week's episode of Opening Soon is all about sourcing. So you've chosen those partners. You've got your lease. You have a business plan. And now you have your budget set for equipment, tableware, interior furnishings, uniforms, and more. Where are you starting? What's the lead time? Where do you save? Where do you splurge?
Yep. So one more time, we are joined by Morgan Tucker, who is the Director of Business Development at Singer Equipment, where she oversees Tabletop, including her signature Little M Tucker line of curated products and partnerships. And Josh Morgan is the COO of Melt Shop and the operating partner of RFI Brands. Both of the our guests came to their current roles after years in nationally recognized restaurants, not by luck, and including Union Square Hospitality Group, as well as the Nomad. Welcome, guys. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Yeah, thanks for having us.
We're happy to have you both. So, Morgan, let's start with you. Tell us about, you know, what M. Tucker does, and you're a 100-year-old company, basically, at this point. So I think you've seen a few restaurants open. Tell us how you help people and all about it.
Absolutely. We certainly have been around for 101 years now. We celebrated our 100th anniversary last year. The Singer Equipment Company is one of the largest distributors in the U.S., the largest on the Eastern Seaboard, and we do contract design, supply, heavy equipment, light equipment, smallwares, janitorial, and then tabletop, as well as other front-of-house items.
So everything from mop and bucket to a new grill to fancy ceramics on the table.
And everything in between.
Full package.
Yep.
Cool.
The full package. And Josh, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into like hospitality. And
so I kind of stumbled into the restaurants on a whim. I was living in Chicago with some friends, always had this kind of entrepreneurial drive within me. Didn't know what to do with it, but I felt it. And me and my buddies thought that the most logical approach was to get into the restaurant business.
Oh, yeah, logical.
So we weren't very naive back then. And I kind of just told myself, look, if I'm going to do it, if I'm going to pursue this entrepreneurial path via restaurants, let's learn the business. So I applied to Houston's restaurant training group, training manual. Got accepted. Thankfully, I don't know how I did it at the time, because I had zero experience.
Yeah.
But ended up getting into the program and learned the business from them. And they're arguably one of the best operators in the country in full service, and they have a great reputation. There's two locations in New York, so I'm sure people around here know them. And I fell in love with the business. From then on, you know, I did a couple different things. I took a sidestep, did some real estate, and then the restaurant business was calling me back. And I opened up my own restaurant in Manhattan, had that for about a year and a half. And then I joined the Nomad team and opened up the Nomad Project, which was an amazing, amazing project to be part of.
And then you switched into quick service.
And then I switched into quick service.
The same exact thing as working at a Michelin starred restaurant.
Exactly. Exactly the same thing. You know what, we were talking about this earlier, but a lot of people told me when I mentioned that I was considering the switch into fast casual, that it's so different. There's so many more elements that you don't know about. And the reality is that part of that is true. Like, there are certainly some things that you need to figure out that are different in fast casual versus fine dining. But the principles I've found to be completely the same. You know, whether you're in fast casual, fine dining, casual dining, or, you know, fast food, like, we're in the business of connecting with our guests and trying to create experiences,
right?
Maybe in 30 seconds or in 4 hours, but you're trying to connect with people in a meaningful way. And I find that ultimately that's the same. And, you know, maybe how people go about it is different, but what we've done at RFI Brands and Melt Shop is to try to connect with our guests in a meaningful way in a very short period of time. And all of what we do, whether it be our food design, the partners we use, the packaging, it's all aimed to try to create an impact.
Yeah, I almost feel like it's harder to connect with somebody it is harder.
You literally have less time.
Yeah, you literally have less time.
We have, you know, 30 to 40 seconds at the cashier.
That's
when you're
it.
Taking the order.
Yeah.
Then you maybe have 5 seconds when you're handing off the order to someone else.
You're a true operations guy that you know down to the seconds.
Yeah.
I love
it's
it.
It's all about the seconds.
I love it. So speaking, like, what are some of those touch points that have been like instrumental in your brand that you've like sourced from the beginning that are like, say, uncompromising, that you're like, these are touch points that we have to connect with the guest on?
Yeah. I mean, so our mission, we actually have a mission at Melt Shop, which is literally to connect with our guests and each other. So everything we do, we try to bring back to that mission statement. But, you know, it's about hospitality. It's about, you know, going above and beyond. Clearly food and service is expected, but the way we talk about it is that that's the baseline expectation. You know, you gotta be so far above those expectations. And to do that, you've gotta engage, you've gotta educate, you've gotta be friendly with your guests when they walk into your restaurant. You've gotta always be smiling. And it's hard to do that when it's very repetitious. You know, you just have people coming in after, you know, minute after minute. So It's tough, but you know, it's all about the sequence of service.
Hard problem to have people coming in minute after minute, isn't it? I'm like, oh, what a hard problem to have. No, that's a good problem to have. I love it.
No, it's a great problem to try to solve.
Yeah, awesome. So Morgan, tell us a little bit about so you guys have opened tons of restaurants. What have you seen as people being like, this is really instrumental in how I'm going to connect with the guest? Like what kind of things do you provide to sort of help with those touch points?
For us, it's really about the service that we can provide to the chefs and the restaurateurs. If we can give them a meaningful, enjoyable experience that's going to carry them throughout the day. If we make it challenging when our drop comes in the morning, or even if our driver's been in traffic or truck's broken down or who knows what can happen, we've heard it all. It's really the way that we engage with our customers that then allows them to continue to service their customers.
And I can certainly vouch for that because my connection to Morgan's was I was at Nomad and I was kind of running our CGS program, China Glass Silver. And I had worked with a guy named Scott Clayman from M. Tucker, who was phenomenal. And he was just one of the greatest partners. We try to call we don't like to use the name vendor. We prefer to use the term partner because we think that establishing a value around, you know, we can't do it without them, they can't do it without us, is super important.
As somebody who could technically be called a vendor, we look at all the restaurants we work with.
I never thought about it like that.
Partners.
We want to be your partner.
We want to be your partner.
your partners in our book. Yeah. But I was working with Scott, so then when I went to Orify Brands and Melt Shop, Scott was so good that I brought Scott and the M. Tucker team to Orify, and then we built this great relationship. Unfortunately, Scott passed in a tragic, it was an untimely death, but Morgan then took over essentially the account. And look, the reason why I was so emphatic about bringing this partner over was because of the service, because of the ability for him and Morgan and the other people on their team to just be responsive and timely and accommodating all of our needs, because we're not easy people to work with. I'm sure you guys know this. We have a lot of demands.
I think most people are, go about, especially when they're opening their restaurant, they're thinking about each little piece that they want to get and where they're going to get it, and probably wouldn't necessarily think to come to an M. Tucker and be able to get all those things from them. Can you give us, I know that you guys work together and you probably thought about that at one point. Tell us, the difference between sourcing each piece from a different from a different partner, not vendor.
Yep.
And how that changes, what you're able to do with your business.
So from our perspective, ideally, vendor consolidation is important to us. It simplifies operations. So if we can get as many items, let's say in small wares, from just one vendor partner, that's preferable. And M. Tucker really did offer that. All of our disposables and small wares we've been getting from M. Tucker probably for 6 years now. Wow. So that's one important element, especially on Melt Shop. On the full service side, for instance, we have our Little B Table brand, which Morgan and I worked very closely with when we launched that about 5 years ago. You tend to want fancier things and you want the nicest plateware and the silver, and there is a tendency to go to different vendors to get it. And I think it's just a balance. It's a balance of how do you articulate your brand, how do you do so in a way that resonates with the guest, and then how do you do so also in a way that makes financial sense, and that's that's economical, right, and also doesn't drive your GM and your managers crazy because they have to order from 10 different partners.
Yeah,
as a vendor, we just want to know what your expectations are.
Yeah,
and if you can give us a really great vision of your concept, which Little Beat has always been, then we can be the best partner for you because we understand exactly what your needs and wants are. And when someone doesn't have their vision down and they don't set the right expectations for any of their partners, they're really setting themselves up for failure.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting point. So people come to you and you're like, the best case scenario, just for our listeners too, as you're getting organized, have what do they need to turn the keys over to you, and where can you guys be the most helpful and save people money?
It really is dependent on the concept.
Yeah.
Like Josh said before, we've worked with him and his teams at the highest level of service and at much more of a fast casual, right, quick service model. So I think for us, it's understanding what you're looking to get from a distribution partner, and we can accommodate any of the requests. So we can do, like I said earlier, design services. We can work with your designers and we can just source the equipment for you. We can source the exact equipment. We can value engineer the equipment if you're looking to save money. Right. And we can do that exact process for all the aspects.
Interesting. And I thought something else that was really interesting to you, to me when we were chatting before is about like the like having trucks have clearance. So there's like logistical things that like you might not think of when you're trying to like save money on one end. So like the trucks from M. Tucker have like security clearance at some of the big buildings in Manhattan, which I would have like never even thought about.
It almost goes back to some of our other episodes of just like kind of, you know, knowing where to outsource in a way so that you can focus on, you know, the things that you're really good at, which is, you know, is it accepting packages from 18 different people and, you know, coordinating when UPS is going to pick up, when it's going to deliver, or do you have like a logistical team that's basically working?
We have a great warehouse guy. He's probably the heart and soul of our company, yeah. But he's going to hate me when I say, you know, for our good customers, we'll do pretty much anything. and that's warehouse products that, you know, really complete the package that we're making weekly or daily drops to our customers. Anyway, we can throw on some of the specialty melt shop custom designs.
Thank you for doing that.
speaking of custom, why don't we like everybody wants custom, and it's certainly, you know, it's the core of our personal business with Tilt NYC, but tell us how you see that custom affects your business, Josh, and how, you know, how you've been able to work with people, you know, aside from Josh, and developing whether it's plates or uniforms or flatware or everything.
Yeah, for sure. One thing we were saying earlier is, you know, what percentage of people want something that's custom? And it's 100%.
100%
of customers want to know that what they're doing and what they're receiving as far as goods and services are unique and special. And that's definitely a service that we pride ourselves on. Anything that you're going to buy from us, we'll make sure that there's not someone just next door with the same, you know, bill of service.
And is there always like, I mean, I know for us, it's not necessarily a premium. So I think it's, you know, is it always necessarily a premium for custom?
It's really not necessarily. I know we talked about, you know, knowing where to spend and knowing where to cut costs.
Right.
And I think, again, if, you know, having something with a custom mark or a custom logo or your brand on it is important, then we can make that part of the bundle of services at the, like the highest level and then work from there. But custom packaging, as far as disposables are concerned, I know that you could probably speak to specific numbers, but when someone's walking around with a product that has their name on it, your name on it, there really is like no amount of money that, I mean, you could say it's worth.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, it's free advertising.
It's free advertising. It's marketing. You know, so we've been working with M. Tucker for several years, and they've helped us with all of our custom packaging. And in fast casual, the paper portion of your spend, you know, is a big part of your total cost of goods. So we're constantly trying to monitor that, stay within a certain range. And we've gone through so many iterations from, you know, on the branding side, on the actual paper product side. And really, it's just, you know, it's a balance. Like, you're trying to get that branding out, you know, take advantage of that free marketing, getting those eyeballs on your products, but at the same time doing so in a way that makes sense and it's financially feasible. And we were talking about this a little earlier, but we had spent a decent amount of money on these custom bags that had a little cutout handle.
The die cut. Morgan's having a
die cut headache.
You still might have a couple hundred cases of that in store. No, just kidding. but you know, we spent a lot of money because we thought that, you know, that's what best articulated our brand. And they were great bags, but we have since over the years learned that we can still accomplish a similar effect with great branding with just a more, you know, a standard off the shelf type of bag. And we've since migrated to that. And you know, look, it's a little bit of a push and pull. You know, the pendulum is constantly swinging to one of the other sides.
Yeah, and the other thing I thought that was interesting that we talked about is like some of the brands, like with the sustainability component, where they value that, but you have to make sure your customer is like willing to pay for it. You know?
Yeah, there's been a huge trend in recent years to be sustainable, to do things and offer products that are good for the environment. And Fields Good Chicken, Morgan was commenting on this. I don't even know if I realized it, but they were one of the first brands to go fully compostable
one
with
of
all
of
their plastics and, you know, utensils. And you know, the reality is we all believe in this and we all think it's important. And we all, I think, in somewhere in our priority list are trying to make progress. But there also has to be a balance. You know, so for Melt Shop, we are not fully compostable. We still use plastics, some plastic utensils and straws, not because we don't want to, you know, provide them. we do think it's important, but we also have to make sure that the guests, you know, are it matters to them, and also that it makes sense financially, you know, because it is a big premium to turn those on.
Yeah.
And you know, look, it's sometimes it's a business decision, sometimes it's a, you know, environmental decision, and it's about the balance, right? You can never be just all or nothing one way. It's kind of trying to find that happy medium.
I would say that it.
Sorry.
I would say that people are always like hyper focused on sustainable disposables, and they often forget about sustainable kitchen equipment on the heavy equipment sector, yeah. And then sustainable plateware, glassware, flatware. If you're outfitting a kitchen and your sustainable mission is front and center, please make sure that you understand where your plates are coming from,
yeah,
or where your apparel is coming from.
Or that your fryer is, like you said. That
exactly.
Yeah, tell us about the fryer.
It's just heavy equipment is rated, and there's some pieces of heavy equipment in kitchens that offer a sustainable mission or are trying to do the right thing, and maybe you're just blissfully unaware. But please educate yourselves, because equipment is... I mean, the equipment sector grows at the most rapid pace of probably any other in my side of the business. Mm-hmm. But there are so many incredible advancements in sustainable products.
Yeah. So, and speaking of that, like, so tell us a little bit, because you mentioned like technology is changing so much. So tell us a little bit about, like, on the equipment side, when you're outfitting a restaurant, do you want the latest and greatest, and how often are things changing and all that kind of
stuff? Yeah, so it really depends on your concept. We know a lot of people who can find a used Hobart, and it's going to save you a fortune, and we'll totally support something like that. Equipment does kind of advance at the most rapid paces I could recall. Now you go to these trade shows, like we were all just at the NRA show. And
the restaurant show, not the gun show. Sorry. Very different.
The other NRA.
I always like to clarify. All right, sorry, go ahead.
No. And you'll see that like every brand has a line extension or a new product that they're releasing on the show floor. And it never used to be like this. But as we said before, like service agents then need to be aware of how to manage and maintain these specific pieces of equipment. But as long as you find the right service agents who can work on the equipment that you're buying, it really doesn't matter for some pieces that they're older and used, and for others it does matter. And that's really based on your concept and which pieces are going to be your workhorses, right. What you speak about with your kitchen designer,
yeah.
And your contract sales supplier.
It's like bringing your iPhone 2 into the Apple store and expecting
them to know.
Them to like fix it and improve it on the spot. So you feel like people, like the... technicians are up to date with, like, because it's turning over so fast, you feel like they're up to date with the
I think they are, but
tech.
I think that service, you know, we're in, right now we're in Manhattan. I don't actually live in Manhattan, but wherever you are, yeah. There are different types of service agents, and the speed at which someone can come to you on a weekend or a night is extremely important in the middle of service, and just making sure that you know who your service agents are right before you open and what pieces of equipment they're equipped to service.
And the kitchen equipment game is tough, because there's always that shinier penny that comes out.
Right.
You know, and you want it, and you want the custom, and you want the, you know, chefs, especially in full service, like that's their arena, right? So they want it to be fully functioning at the highest level.
And it's where
level.
They spend like the greatest hours of their day.
Hello, exactly. Like 120 hours a week.
Yeah, so you can very easily spend millions, you know, on just a beautiful kitchen. You know, not that it's right or wrong, but it can just very quickly add up. So at the fast casual level, what we're trying to do is we're trying to accomplish the similar thing, like standardization with equipment that's durable, that does what it needs to do, that fits within our process. But then we got to try to strip away all of the fancy bells and whistles. And, you know, so Melt Shop, we were doing custom stuff. And then now everything is slide in. You literally roll it in and you hook it up, because we've...
Because you have 15 locations.
Because we have 15 locations and we're opening 10 more by the end of the year. So we have to know that the equipment package is standardized, it's fixed, that it's easy to install, that, you know, it accomplishes all those scalable checkboxes, I guess.
And do you have technician partners and... you know, that are on call or on hand for all those things?
So we go through the, when we select a piece of equipment, like a TurboChef, we use TurboChef conveyor air impingement technology for our sandwiches. Do you like it when I talk dirty?
Yeah, like, come again?
Yeah.
Is there one of those in each shop?
So we have two of them. So we double up. So we stack them for redundancy. So that's one of the things we'll consider, what happens if we lost a major piece of equipment. But then we select a TurboChef because we know... we've met with the reps, like we've gone to their facilities. We've, you know, we know what the troubleshooting R&M, you know, implications are of that equipment. We know who the local, New York provider or the Florida, service provider will be if it does go down. So, you kind of got to vet out some of those things. And MTucker is great and can help, answer a lot of those questions as well. So if you go to the NRA show and you see a new piece of equipment and you have questions, you can go to them and ask, what are the implications? Yeah. Does it work? Right. Is it durable? Do you have other, partners that you've worked with in Manhattan that I can go see and visit and kick the tires?
Interesting. So you go and you visit other restaurants who are using it.
Yeah. As long as they're cool with it.
Yeah. But that's a good point. I mean, that speaks to your point earlier about your vendors aren't vendors, they're partners, because you don't want an oh shit.
And your customers are partners too. I mean, we have so many customers who act as test kitchens.
Yeah.
Where you can go and ask them questions, and they've just gotten a pretty sweet deal on purchasing that piece of equipment so that they can be.
I know. So you do give people if people are going to test out a new piece of equipment, do you guys give them special deals and stuff?
If they're willing to be someone where we can send other people and they are, eloquent and informed. We have some people who will buy the equipment and they're supposed to, connect it to their phone and monitor the, all the metrics and make sure that, everything's reporting up to the cloud so that the manufacturer can then get that data. And if you're doing all of these things, then you become a real asset for the manufacturer.
So noted on ways to save money, be a partner and guinea pig it, and you might get some sweet equipment for a discount. So actually we're going to take a super quick break and then we'll come back with more. Founders Daniel and Susan opened a rustic hotel and restaurant on a sandy beach in Tulum, Mexico. At the hotel's restaurant, they source local ingredients and fresh fish delivered by local fishermen directly to the hotel's beach by boat. Salmas embodies the warm and adventurous spirit of Tulum, and since 1993, it has been an iconic destination for locals and tourists alike. Bento helped them build an online image and colorful new website that captures the essence of Tulum and inspires visitors to book a trip to the resort's many offerings. Salmas is one of 4,000 that's powered by Bento. Visit getbento.com/openingsoon to learn more.
All right, welcome back. Again, we're chatting with Morgan Tucker and Josh Morgan, and we're talking about sourcing and kind of figuring out how you go about getting all of the equipment into your restaurant once you've got the lease and everything signed. A couple wrap-ups from the first half is, number one, your vendors are not vendors. They're your partners. They're in it with you. So if you work well with them, then make sure that you treat them that way or that you feel that way about them. Number two is to focus on your strengths. So if you have the opportunity to work with MTucker or a company like MTucker that can handle the logistics, just aside from the equipment itself, the shipping and all those things, it can really take a lot off your plate. And number three is to make sure that your service agents and that they're going to be, quick and willing and responsive to whatever equipment that you've bought. And lastly, kind of in the same vein, is to vet that equipment. So find out, any great equipment supplier should be willing to share some of their clients that are going to speak highly and let you see the product. So go check it out on hand and see what kind
of... Do a kitchen tour for your friends.
Take it in. That's all I got.
Yeah. So I think one thing, speaking of the latest and greatest and one thing that we had talked about before, and I think that's really important to a lot of our listeners is how do you actually pay for all this stuff? So when you're starting, so we talked a little bit about financing versus just having the cash, and just curious about your thoughts.
So, financing can be tough, or just paying for restaurants can in general be tough. They're very expensive, which is why, what I was saying earlier, keeping your costs down whenever you can is super important. I think most people go through kind of different phases. They go through friends and family, raises, where they're trying to just aggregate and syndicate some money. Sometimes doing a financing package on equipment can certainly help preserve some cash for operations. For instance, the partner that we work with, so we have equity partners at Orify. They actually have a division in their financing group that will specifically finance equipment package.
Oh, really?
Sometimes, it may be difficult to qualify depending on where you're at, whether it's your first restaurant, whether you have a couple, but our franchise partners, for instance, I can go to them and I can say, hey, if you're interested in financing your equipment package, here's a contact or here's a name. You can reach out to them. And then it's just kind of on them to see whether they can qualify and take advantage And there's several companies out there that can do financing on things like equipment. Thankfully now, you know, as we've progressed, you know, from the early days of just trying to figure it all out, we pay for everything up front.
Yona's always going to save money, and if that's the case, as long as you can have it.
Long term, so, it's obviously less expensive.
Right. If you can build it into the business plan, then always have enough cash to buy your equipment outright. But
yep. But it's tough. Look, it's tough. You know, financing in general is tough. I mean, you know, do you guys have any at M. Tucker? You have referrals for financing arms.
We do. Companies? We have a lot of people who still continue. It's like historically been known to like lease warewashing equipment, so we can point you in different directions. We have some creative ways, people that we can, you know, introduce who could potentially support. But it's really, you know, one of those areas where it's something tangible. It's an asset that you'll own for a very long time, and you're going to be the one who's taking care of it. So if it's something that you can pay for up front, for us, that's really the direction that we push.
I am a big believer, I have been historically, and especially in full service, for pieces of equipment that require a lot of ongoing maintenance to consider leasing options. So for warewashing, you know, we actually currently partner with Ecolab. Not for warewashing, but for our chemicals in general. Yeah. But in a full service restaurant where you're going to get such high usage and volume on your machine, leasing might be a good option. So you get to save the money, the upfront cost on buying a piece of equipment like that. Same thing with ice machines. You know, there's a lot of great leasing options for ice machines. You know, bars that
they
tend to be very finicky.
Like a service package or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah. And if you go down, they'll deliver ice. You know,
Oh, really?
You know, years ago, Cold Draft was super important. You know, the square 1x1 ice cubes everyone wanted. Now there's all sorts of varieties of it, but you know, those machines go down a lot, and you do not want to. Well, I mean, depending on
like define a lot.
Depending on the manufacturer, some are just finicky. Right. But anyways, point being, you know, if there's going to be high volume and potential high maintenance, leasing is a good option. And again, warewashing
and ice machines, everything full else service. You need to build in to actually purchase, basically, from what you're seeing, right, Morgan?
From what I'm seeing, I think that there's opportunities where you can potentially look to buy something secondhand. But a lot of the equipment that we're selling today is suggested to buy.
Yeah.
Do you guys do any secondhand or no?
We don't.
Only brand new.
Then you get the built-in warranties. You know,
right. Exactly.
It varies from the manufacturer, but most of these manufacturers have pretty substantial warranty programs.
And if you know to ask for the extended warranties, and you ask your dealer partner or you ask the manufacturer for the extended warranties, they'll often be amenable.
Cool. So ask for an extended warranty.
Yes. It's amazing.
Very important. She's like, ask, yeah. So Morgan's going like wink, wink
you
in the studio.
Ask, no,
if they don't ask, they don't give it to you, people. So ask for the extended warranty.
Yeah, it's easy to forget to ask.
Yeah.
One of the other things I thought that could be helpful is kind of knowing when to buy. Like,
timeline.
How long does it take to get that crazy grill that you guys have? How long
does Turbo Chef
take to get, you know, custom ceramics built? Like, are there things that you know that people should, you know, start thinking about 6 months out, or like,
I think customization is king now, and even on the heavy equipment side. So there's less stuff that's sitting on the shelves because everyone has the option to do something a little bit unique, a little bit special.
Right.
So for that reason, I almost think there's less product sitting on the shelves, even though it's probably faster to manufacture today than ever before. So there is that fine line. I would say on tableware, which is really my area of expertise, I would give it 4 to 6 months if you want to do something really special and unique and you want to make sure that everything to your exact specifications is there for opening day.
How do you deal when people don't have 4 to 6 months? Because we get this a lot too
in our show.
There's always, you know, a way to try and work through it. But
there's always stuff on our shelves.
Right.
We have two warehouses with over 150,000 square feet of products in Elverson, Pennsylvania and Paterson, New Jersey. So we can open your restaurant tomorrow and it'll look damn great, but it just won't be custom.
Compromise.
Right. But people, I know it's like people want custom stuff in 2 weeks and you're like,
are there, you know, we talked about this as the, you know, one of the components of building and, you know, building on a budget and being a little bit scrappy. Can you, Josh, would you recommend, like, can you buy something today that'll get you 6 months while you like start to generate revenue and then go get the really incredible, you know, glassware.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think ultimately you have to make some tough business decisions between what is, you know, a need versus a want, or what's a luxury, or what is something that I can just get through with, you know, through opening.
Right.
And sometimes those decisions are tough to make when it's like your first, you know, location. It's the first time proving out your brand. You're trying to make a big statement. And we, I think, as restaurateurs or entrepreneurs, we all get kind of stuck into that mindset where you think the thing that you think is going to equate to bigger business or bigger is not really the thing that's equaling it, you know? So it's just hard to step outside and kind of look at, okay, is that plate or that silver or that machine or that custom, you know, equipment that is taking me 6 months to make, is that really moving the needle? And I think if you try to pragmatically step outside of yourself during those early days, which is very hard to do, the answer is often no, you know, that you don't need that extra spend or that extra, you know, bells and whistles. And you know, look, it's a hard discipline. And I think a lot of times at scale, you're forced to realize that discipline. Like we have at Melt Shop, you know, if you're opening 10 restaurants, you can't change. I mean, if we change one bag or one piece of equipment, it literally will derail our entire construction schedule and timing and ordering. So it's almost like it's forced on you. But then you learn, like, oh yeah, that thing I actually did need that thing. You know, I could have gotten away with, you know, the stock.
I would say that when you first open, people really identify with the products that are tactile in your space. So it may be that last 5 or 10% of your spend, but there's such an intimate connection with those products, and that's what's being photographed. So I often get so upset when someone at the last minute compromises on china, glassware, flatware, takeaway goods.
So get a used fryer, but get a brand new tableware set for the first 6 months
true,
and then
but
go back.
No,
and,
there's a lot of truth in that.
There is a lot of truth in that because, I mean, that's a really good point. And we say this all the time, too. It's like people really think about, like, everything within their space, and then they, like, didn't do anything for their staff uniform, and that's who the guest is, like, intimately interacting with on like a touch base. So, I mean, that is true. And especially in like the Instagram age, you can't deny that like your food will be photographed, whether it's a grilled cheese and its packaging or like, you know, at a Michelin star.
And I think that's a great point, because when you make that list of the things that you know, you feel like you need versus the things that maybe you can save on, you know, that list, certainly at the top of that list should be the things that your guests are engaging with or that the guests are seeing. So uniform, stemware, plateware, like those are the things that create that experience that I was talking about earlier. Yeah. So sometimes you have to spend on those things because they are super important, especially when you're getting off the ground.
And then the chefs need to share their design ideas with the front of house partner, right?
So basically, sure you don't do not need that custom piece of heavy equipment. Is that a place to save? I don't know.
I think opening months.
Makes sense. It's like just to give an example, like on a fryer, you could save $1,000 on one fryer just by removing the computers that control the touchscreen, right? So it can be super fancy, like a cockpit, or it can be just push one button. So there's a lot of money to be saved in just
features. Used a fryer with a digital buttons on it. So that sounds
they're out there
really impressive.
So there's money to be chipped off, you know, on those budgets.
Cool. I think that's been some great insight.
Yeah, that is good.
You want to move on to lightning round?
Yes, let's do some lightning round. Okay, so yeah, so these are just meant to be quick, like 1 to 2 word answers off the top of your head. So favorite splurge when opening a new restaurant or place to splurge?
Can I say walk-on mats?
Walk-in mats.
Walk-on mats. So I don't like the roll-up mats. I just don't like the way they look, so I like the built-in. They call them walk-off mats.
Okay.
They're built into the floor. They have like a grate.
Interesting.
Spencer, I don't think I've won that battle yet. I think
Spencer,
we still
are
have
you listening?
That's my splurge.
Recommended splurge, Morgan?
Oh, I have so many. Like, in what category?
Just whatever your favorite.
I would say something that we talk about in the kitchen at the Chef's Garden is a blast chiller. Like, that you didn't know. I mean, I guess you knew you kind of needed
blast
it, but now they
nice.
Like can't live without it.
Do you have blast chillers at any of your spots?
We do at Little Beat.
You do? Okay. Yep.
I love that
Morgan knows what equipment that they have. Like the Orify brand. She's like, Little Beat in Midtown has. No, I'm just kidding. Cool. One common mistake you see people make when sourcing or when opening?
Oh, gosh. For me, it's that your concept is you know, this American born and bred, and then your China is from China.
Yeah, you know, details matter. I would agree with that. I think.
Or your apparel matter. Is not right. Made in the USA.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that.
For me, it's just not picking the right partner. You know, I mean, that means so much to us. Like, people work with people that they don't like or don't have this mutual respect and appreciation for, and it's just not worth it. Our partners help us succeed. It's the most important thing.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, from this conversation today, it's like business partners or like vendor partners. Definitely.
Means so much.
Most exciting sustainable initiative in QSR.
Ooh. I think the straws are interesting.
The strawless lid or the paper straw?
The paper straw.
Yeah.
And the lids as well, you know, as like another option. It's hard because a lot of people don't, the quality of the paper is not very durable and there's not much longevity.
That's why I like the strawless lid. I feel like those are great.
Yeah, which is super cool. But we have not begun to tackle this, but we are certainly talking about it.
Do you see a lot of people picking those up?
It's actually remarkable how many different types of companies have gone into the paper straw category and still no one can get something that really works. We've seen like beeswax line, which is like also not really sustainable. So it's always a challenge.
There must have been a dozen or more vendors at NRA.
Oh my God.
Just paper straws. What about the bamboo straws? Are those? I feel like those are a good option.
I mean, you said Nomad before. I know they use like the hay straws, which are obviously at a premium price point.
Why do we need straws? Somebody remind me.
I know. What about the lids?
I don't know. For me, it's not an enjoyable drinking experience. But
the habit, I think, is a real consumer habit. Real challenge.
It's very hard. Unless you feel like you're drinking out of like a little baby bottle sometimes.
It's like a coffee. It's a coffee cup thing, right?
What is a sippy cup?
A sippy cup, yep.
Morgan, your dream restaurant client to outfit.
I've been so lucky. We really have. I mean, this year we worked with Tack Room. So like, what's more dream than Thomas Keller?
Yeah.
I think right now we're doing a lot of work with Marriott Luxury Brands, and that's super exciting for me. They have intention and thoughtfulness, and they really try to be on brand and obviously a little bit less budget conscious. So as long as the products are really authentic and can withstand the rigors of the operations that they're being put into, they're special.
And Josh, what about the dream location for the next melt shop?
A dream location?
Yeah.
I think the West Coast. I'd like to tackle LA area.
Now you guys are on the Eastern Seaboard.
We're pretty much mid-Atlantic. We're starting to go down south, opening Florida in the next couple of months, actually.
That's exciting.
But I think making that West Coast jump.
Yeah, so West Coast
before the airport. We talked about the airport.
No, the West. That's like ideal. I think I think it'll take a little while to get to the West Coast.
Okay.
Maybe at least 12 months, 18 months.
Yeah. That's not that long.
Yeah.
In reality.
Remember when long used to be like 10 years?
He's like long, 12 months. Anyways, I think we touched a little bit on this, but what's your favorite kitchen or restaurant gadget that you've seen recently?
Whoever. I saw at NRA a ventless fryer.
I thought you were going to say your robot.
Oh, Flippy.
Flippy.
You have a robot?
I don't know anything about Flippy. Right. I just know that it was.
Flippy is definitely cooler than the ventless fryer. But the ventless fryer is cool because we're exploring a prototype without hoods, which is something we're really excited about. But Flippy is a robotic arm that fries, that drops baskets into fryers for you.
No. And do you have that in any of your restaurants?
No. We just saw it at NRA. And the robot's name is Flippy. We developed a relationship. It's a robotic arm that drops
the fryer baskets.
It just takes, a lot of the manual processes involved in QSR that are hard to do and dirty. Not physically dirty, but they're perceived as like a dirtier job.
Right.
Manning a fryer is hot, it's dangerous, it's there's oil everywhere, it smells.
Yeah.
So like kind of removing that and being able to reallocate that type of labor to doing something like touching guests or creating experiences has drastic implications for the brand. So
What's the price tag on Flippy?
I actually don't know. The rep had a tough time giving us prices.
Is it a prototype or this is something that's actually in production?
This one is. It's from some company out in California. I think it is live in a couple test locations. I don't remember where. It's very early, I think, preliminary kind of tech. But But that whole notion of like automating, you know, not using automation to replace, right, but to reallocate to more important parts of our business is super compelling to us.
Yeah. Going from there, not your favorite, but like an essential kitchen gadget, like every kitchen should get. Morgan.
We have a bunch of new advancements in like time and temperature. So thermometers, pH, infrared, and then a dishwasher thermometer. So there's some pretty cool.
Keep the health department off your back.
Oh my gosh, what a week for New York.
You got to be DOH ready.
Yeah. Yeah,
for sure. And then the last one is your biggest oh shit moment for both of you, I guess. Something that's like, I don't know, been tragic in delivery or wildly new equipment that came out or...
I think one of mine was when I convinced Spencer to adopt a new configuration of our line. It was called, we called it the horseshoe.
Okay.
So it was meant to just have
at
this
at
Melt Shop. It was meant to have a continuous flow of the sandwich around this horseshoe until it found its way out to the guest. And it was a disaster. And Spencer still doesn't let me live it down.
Aww.
And it's still actually in two of our restaurants. So, and the reason
why
it was
a disaster, you have a straight line?
We have two different versions, but it was way too long. So the distance between where the guest handoff was to the equipment was just ridiculously long.
Okay.
So I've ceased all operations as a kitchen designer.
Okay. Know your strengths. Yeah.
We have so many stories of driving. You know, we take 20 trucks into Manhattan every day with single man teams. So you never know.
So be nice to your drivers.
Never know what can happen.
Yeah. They're your partners.
They're your partners. Be nice to the drivers. Let's just quickly shout out some restaurants or friends who are opening soon. Did you guys have anybody you wanted to shout out?
You know I do.
Yeah, tell me.
All right. So opening last week, so I know it's not opening soon, but shout out to two of my favorite people in the whole world. Brad Kilgore and Soraya Kilgore opened Ember last week.
Yeah.
And what's super cool about Ember for us at LMT Provisions is that they actually used three of our vendor partners' tablewares together in this like awesome, you know, explosion of black and blue and gold heaven from Anfora, who Josh is a big fan of, and Robert Gordon Pottery, which is an Australian ceramicist we brought here, and then Felt and Fat, which is hyper local out of Philadelphia.
Out of Philly, yeah.
Yeah, Nate, who you guys know. So
cool.
And then so many other projects they're working on.
Anybody you want to shout out, Josh?
Our sister brand, so Little Bee Table, is opening up in Greenwich, Connecticut, which will be our first restaurant, actually our second restaurant outside of Manhattan. But, you know, stone's throw away. So we still kind of consider it our backyard. So that'll be the end of June, I think.
Cool.
Right on Greenwich Ave.
Cool. Exciting.
So we're excited for that.
All right. Next week, tune in as we chat design and build out with Missy Robbins. She's the chef owner of Lilia and Missy Restaurants in Brooklyn. I'm sure you've heard of her. We'll explore how creativity, budget, and utility, which is super important, all play a role in how you design your first and perhaps your second restaurants. Special thanks again to Morgan and Josh for talking us through the process of sourcing. If you were late to class or forgot your pencil, we've got your back. You can check our blog on tillitnyc.com to catch our wrap-up of key points from today. Can you guys tell everybody where to find you?
Yeah, for sure. We're at Singer M. Tucker at LMT Provisions and Little M. Tucker.
And in Melt Shop, we have five locations in Manhattan. Little Beat has, I think, six or seven in Manhattan. We've also got Little Beat Table, one location on Park Avenue. Feels Good Chicken, four locations with a fifth coming soon.
It's easy to find you.
And then
it's hard
and
to
then
find
you. I got to give props. We're also, all the five guys in the city are part of our company. So we've got 13 of them.
Oof. Wow. Busy guy. Well, thanks for joining us. Follow The Journey on Heritage Radio and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcast. Don't forget to follow us on @WeAreOpeningSoon and @TillitNYC. And if you love what we're doing, then tell everyone you know. Go on your podcast app and follow us, rate us, and review us. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.